The Supreme Court heard arguments today in two cases that pose fundamental questions about the U.S. war on terror. At issue in both cases, whether the Constitution permits the president to order the indefinite imprisonment of an American citizen without charge or access to judicial process. Two men classified as enemy combatants who have been held incommunicado for 2 years are challenging their imprisonment. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg was at the court today.
The first case to be argued today was brought on behalf of Yasser Hamdi, an American-born Saudi seized in Afghanistan by the Northern Alliance and turned over to U.S. authorities. He's been held in a windowless cell ever since, and until a month ago when he was permitted to see his lawyer, his only contact was with his jailers and interrogators. Public defender Frank Dunham read about Hamdi's detention 2 years ago and launched a legal battle on his behalf. Today in the Supreme Court, Dunham told the justices that the constitutional right of habeas corpus, the right to challenge one's imprisonment in court, dates back to the Magna Carta and the founding of the Republic. Justice Scalia quickly interrupted, noting that anyone captured in a war could claim he was swept up wrongly.
Now, you surely wouldn't allow every captured enemy in a war to go through a habeas proceeding because he wants to challenge the fact, would you?
Your Honor, would you?
I don't know.
No, I wouldn't allow every person captured to go through a habeas proceeding, but there's a different legal status of a U.S. citizen from an enemy alien captured on a battlefield. They have a different status.
Justice Ginsburg chimed in.
Were there regimes in prior wars for entertaining the claims of people who said, I was an innocent bystander?
There were regimes then and there are regimes now, but they haven't been used by the military here. There are outstanding military regulations that provide for a hearing for someone captured on the battlefield to determine their status if there's any doubt as to their status.
Why did the government say we don't want to use the procedure that we use, say, in Vietnam?
As I recall, the answer was we're not required to and we don't choose to do so.
Justice Kennedy wondered how such a hearing procedure would work.
What do you want to happen at this hearing? You get your hearing. Are we supposed to send a Gulfstream over with 10 people who witnessed the capture? I mean, how does this work?
Well, the military's own regulations provide a good guide for how this hearing would work. They allow testimony by affidavit when it's not convenient to obtain it in any other way. And we're living in an age where we're not living in the World War II age. We have fax machines, we have phones that have pictures, you can get depositions.
What if they get a deposition from an American colonel who says this prisoner was turned over to me by allied forces, our Afghan allies, in this combat, and I was assured by them that they had captured him in a firefight? Now, is that going to satisfy our habeas corpus
That would be
review?
Your Honor, that would be a lot more than what we have now.
It certainly would, but you wouldn't accept that, would you?
Well, I wouldn't accept it without Mr. Hamdi having an opportunity to be heard.
Those last questions were from Justice Scalia. Dunham went on to argue that the president cannot on his own, without congressional authorization, order the indefinite imprisonment of U.S. citizens. But Justice O'Connor observed that Congress did authorize presidential action in the wake of the September 11th attacks.
It appears to allow detention of people captured.
The authorization for use of military force does not have the word detention anywhere in it. It talks about use of force, mm-hmm. and it is the equivalent, in our view, of a declaration of war.
But look, it does say in this authorization, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks.
If that is interpreted to mean that he can impose indefinite executive detention on anybody that he thinks is necessary in order to fulfill that command, we could have people locked up all over the country tomorrow without any due process, without any opportunity to be heard.
Dunham summed up his argument, urging the court not to give the executive branch what he called unprecedented power.
I would urge the court not to go down that road. I would urge the court to find that citizens can only be detained by law. And here there is no law. If there is any law at all, it is the executive's own secret definition of whatever enemy combatant is. And don't fool yourselves into thinking that that means somebody coming off a battlefield, because they've used it in Chicago, they've used it in New York, and they've used it in Indiana.
Dunham was followed to the lectern by Deputy Solicitor General Paul Clement. He told the justices that with 10,000 Americans still in Afghanistan, the government is completely justified in holding Hamdi to prevent his return to the battlefield. Moreover, he said the government needs to keep enemy combatants like Hamdi in isolation so that they can provide intelligence information. Justice Kennedy interrupted.
Can you give me any ideas of the outer bounds of how long a detention would take in order to get the value from the interrogation that you want?
Well, Justice Kennedy, I'm not sure I can give you the outer bounds, but what I can say is that the case here before you today in Hamdi and the case in Padilla suggest that the amount of time that is necessary to allow for interrogation without access to counsel in order to get intelligence is not an indefinite period of time.
After all, Clement said, the government did allow Hamdi to see his lawyer after 2.5 years. Clement contended that even without congressional action, the president under the Constitution would have the right to detain Hamdi. But in this case, he maintained, Congress did provide such authorization. Justice Souter expressed doubts about that.
It doesn't follow, however, that it is adequate for all time. The fact is, I will assume that on September 12th, without any authorization from Congress at all, the president could have taken action in relation to this individual, I mean, if he had been fighting on a battlefield, that the president took. But it doesn't follow that the president's authority to do that is indefinite for all time.
There may be some difficult questions down the road, but it bears emphasis that 10,000 United States troops remain on the battlefield
in
Afghanistan.
Well, there are 10,000 troops there, but it's 2.5 years later.
Justice Breyer noted that the Constitution, the Magna Carta, all the underlying documents of democracy have one basic idea that's minimal, that a person contesting something of importance is entitled to a neutral decision-maker and an opportunity to present proofs and arguments.
Is there any reason why you could not have that kind of proceeding, the kind of proceeding that was given in the Gulf War on the battlefield in hundreds of instances, that was given in Iraq in hundreds of instances, the kind of proceeding that the military itself has given over and over and over?
The practical answer that you're looking for assumes a process that's never been provided.
Clement said that Hamdi was afforded a screening process in Afghanistan in which thousands of prisoners were released, but Justice Ginsburg observed that Hamdi has never had the opportunity to speak for himself.
With respect, Justice Ginsburg, he has an opportunity to explain it in his own words. Now, it may not be
during interrogation?
During
interrogation,
during the initial screening, during the screening in Guantanamo.
Well, how about to a neutral decision maker of some kind, perhaps in the military? Is that so extreme that it should not be required?
No, Justice O'Connor, and let me say two things. One is, when the initial screening criteria are applied in the field, for all intents and purposes, that is a neutral decision maker. I mean, as I said before, the Army is not interested in holding people as enemy combatants that don't qualify for that and don't pose a threat.
That argument didn't seem to go down easily, especially with O'Connor.
But have we ever had a situation like this where presumably this warlike status, could last for 25 years, 50 years, whatever it is?
In the midst of any war, the detention may seem like it's indefinite. Because if you talk about a detainee in 1942, they're not going to know how long World War II is going to last, and their detention may seem indefinite, but those detentions have always been approved under the law of war. Second, with respect to al-Qaeda and individuals who are hardcore al-Qaeda operatives, the end of the war is a very difficult thing to perceive.
Clement also argued the second case the court heard today, the case of one-time Chicago gang member Jose Padilla, who was seized 2 years ago when he got off a plane in Chicago and has been held ever since without charge. The government has said it suspected Padilla was planning to detonate a dirty bomb in the U.S., but government officials have said privately that much of Padilla's plans appeared to be loose talk. Clement told the court today that Padilla is no different from someone seized on the battlefield. Justice Kennedy interrupted.
Could you shoot him when he got off the plane?
No, I don't think we could for good and sufficient reasons of discretion.
Well, but I assume that you could shoot someone that you captured on the field of battle.
Not after we captured them and brought them to safety.
Suppose the executive says mild torture, we think, will help get this information. Some systems do that to get information.
Well, our executive doesn't. And I think the fact that executive discretion in a war situation can be abused is not a good and sufficient reason for judicial micromanagement and overseeing of that authority. You have to recognize that in situations where there is a war, where the government is on a war footing, that there, you have to trust the executive.
Representing Padilla in the High Court today was Stanford Law Professor Jennifer Martinez. She pointed to a law that Congress passed in 1970 aimed at preventing anything like the internment of the Japanese in World War II. That law, she contended, trumps any asserted presidential power to imprison without trial a U.S. citizen seized on U.S. soil. The law, she conceded, would not protect Americans captured on the battlefield, but she said it would protect people like Padilla. Well, asked Justice Breyer, what about the person who poses an imminent threat, who's a ticking time bomb?
That's quintessentially a question for Congress, which could hold legislative hearings and, after due deliberation, come to some conclusion about what was required in this context. And that is, in fact, what our democratic allies, the United Kingdom and Israel, have done in passing specific legislation about the preventive detention of suspected terrorists based on legislative finding about
what
periods of time.
Well, that would be, of course, perhaps desirable, but we're faced with a situation of the here and now, and what do we do?
Your Honor,
you just turn loose a ticking time bomb?
That was Justice O'Connor posing one of the many dilemmas that face the court in weighing the demands of security versus liberty in the American democracy. A decision in both cases is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.